Welcome to the Queer Queens podcast with Hilary McCullum. This podcast was funded and supported by the Seamus Heaney Centre at Queen's University Belfast. It was produced and edited by Susie Bloom and recorded by Georgios Varoutsos. Today, we have a group discussion recorded live at the Crescent Arts Centre in conjunction with the Outburst Queer Arts Festival. Please enjoy.
Thanks, everyone. It's good to see you here tonight. We're here for what will be the sixth in our series of Queer at Queen's podcasts that we've been recording over the last few months. So we're going to be recording this session, and I am delighted to have with me five amazing poets that I've had the pleasure of being able to interview over the last few months. And the podcasts are already available on the Seamus Heaney website. And for those of you with the technological know-how, there's a Spotify code, which if you get close enough, you'll be able to use on your app. But if not, you can access the podcast through the Seamus Heaney Centre website. And those podcasts have come about because I've been the publishing fellow at the Seamus Heaney Centre for the past year. And one of the projects I wanted to do was to talk to LGBTQ writers that have come through the Seamus Heaney Centre and talk about, you know, why things have kind of really seemed to be happening for LGBTQ writers from the North at the minute. So I'm delighted to have with me, I'll start at the far side, I'm not very good at left and right. So we've got Paul Maddern, Don Watson, Toby Buckley, Micheál McCann and Padraig Regan. And they're all going to be reading for you shortly, and I'll tell you a bit more about each of them when they each go up to read. Before that, I just have got a couple of thanks that I want to say. So particular thanks to Susie Bloom, who was the producer and editor of the podcast series, to Georgios Varoutsos, who was our sound engineer, and to Connie Galvin, who did the music. Just also thanks very much to Outburst for letting us partner with them for this event. Without further ado, I'm going to introduce our first poet. Padraig Regan is the author of two poetry pamphlets, Delicious by Lifeboat Press in 2016, and Who Seemed Alive and Together Real from the Emma Press in 2017. In 2015, they were a recipient of an Eric Gregory Award, and in 2020, they were awarded the Ireland Chair of Poetry Bursary Prize. They hold a PhD on creative, critical, and hybridised writing practices in medieval texts, and the work of Anne Carson from the Seamus Heaney Centre at Queen's University Belfast, where they were a Kieran Carson Writing and the City Fellow in 2021. This collection is the recipient of the 2021 Clarissa Lourd Prize, awarded by the David Cohen Foundation, and has been shortlisted for the Forward Prize for Best Poetry Collection. And good luck to Padraig. The announcement of the winner of that prize will be, I think, on the 28th of November, so all the best with that. And I don't think I mentioned my name, so I'll just tell you that while we're here. My name is Hilary McCullum, and as I said, I'm the publishing fellow at the Seamus Heaney Centre. Okay, so let's give it up for Padraig.
Hi, what an absolute pleasure it is to be here. You know, I really love Outburst events, and I really love Seamus Heaney Centre events. So it's a particular joy and thrill to see those two things combined. I'm not gonna read from the book. I've been doing a lot of readings from that book, and I'm terribly bored by everything that's in there. I'm going to start with a poem that was actually written at the same time as I was working on the last few poems from my first collection. But this particular poem, I just couldn't find a place for it in the book, so I decided to leave it out. One thing that Hilary and I talked a little bit about in our episode of the podcast is that in some of my poems, I try to let's say, strange the male body, okay? So, you know, I think we have this kind of ingrained cultural association that the default human body is male. And I'm interested in kind of trying to turn that on its head or trying to get away with that, get away from that. This is called Poem for My Chest. In fact, I almost never think about whatever lack I carry there or don't. Its flat actuality, its weightlessness and veinlessness, the minimal risk that a lump of cells might root in its substrate and divide like a bad regime, its ignorance of pain and pain's tidal cadence, the inconvenient bulk of its scaffold and the soft meat breathing under it, its nipples, small, pink, and redundant in their coarse lashes, from which nothing will leak, no matter how many mouths come crawling. I'm going to read a couple of very, very new poems I've just written in the last few weeks. I've spent the last few weeks at Trinity College in Cambridge, and something that I've been working on there is a load of poems about statues. And I know, like, gay poet writes about statues is a little bit, you know, florals in spring, revolutionary. But I thought I would do it anyway. These are all about sort of fragments of Greek statues that are in the Fitzwilliam Museum in Cambridge. I've given them really stupid titles, which are just the code numbers that the museum uses to refer to these statues. So the first one of these is called GR.94.1937. Like driftwood was my first thought, which was not so wrong, him being too a consequence of slow erosion, and fetched up here a continent away from the mountain he was first excavated from. That is, before he was a he, before the gross stone of him was forced into this imago of soft muscle. But it is not the abrasion of his outer layers that you notice first, their reptilian patterning, and not the yellowish clasp opening on his stretched left breast. It is the fracture of his hip that returns him to the purely geological. It is his curved gestalt, extravagant as a hermaphrodite. It is his abnegation of shape that makes him pure gesture, a spurt of stone, unburdened almost of anything that might reduce him to a person, flying over it, in fact. And the second one of these is about a little statuette of Eros, and it's identified as Eros because there are sort of, as the text says, traces of wings on the back of this statue. GR.18.1891 Eros. Traces of wings remain on his back, reads the text, appended to this bone-white foot of stone, like an apology for forcing onto him this burden of a name he never asked to hold or to be held within. And so I bent my neck as far as the glass allows, and see two milky folds pointing like labia their faint sloped arrow towards the contrapposto hummocks of his ass. There is an old idea that before we were condemned to the sexed body, we lived eight-limbed, two-faced, complete, and that what we call love is just our best attempt to repossess the double nature of ourselves. This is the opposite of what he represents. He is the whole the self was built to mask and can't. Thank you.
Thanks, Padraig. I was going to say a bit about those poems, but actually I think I'm going to leave that for the conversation, or we'll get sidetracked. So I'm going to just go straight ahead with introducing Micheál McCann. Micheál was born and raised in Derry, but is now based in Belfast. He has published poems in journals and magazines across the island of Ireland and in the UK. His poems have appeared or are forthcoming in Poetry Ireland Review, Queering the Green, The Manchester Review, Banshee Lit, Ambit, The Tangerine and The New Frontier, contemporary writing from and about the Irish border. His essay, The Art of Staying, featured in the BBC's Another Northern Ireland series in 2021. His first pamphlet of poems, Safe Home, was published in 2020 by Green Bottle Press. His second pamphlet, Keeper, has recently been published by 14 Poems. Thanks, Micheál.
Hello there, how's it going? It's a real pleasure to be here. Thank you, Hilary. Thank you, Outburst. Thank you, Crescent. Thank you, the Heaney Centre. I'll read a couple of poems from this most recent pamphlet that was just out in August. Haircut with beard trimmer. By halves, I do not do things. So this windowless bathroom becomes a musky, masculine smelling salon. Towels rolled, toilet rolls stowed. A starling blue towel draped over the thin radiator warmly to sculpt around your neck. You reverse cowboy the toilet seat and I set to work. an untrained brutalist, gently hacking unsubtle gaps in a burgeoning scalp, where blue veins, like curious dolphins, threaten to approach the surface. I am the assistant playing games as the tired master eats some lunch, and yet to hold a head heavy with duty, whose curls tighten with weariness. The fuzzy loops of you fall to the tiles like duck tears or rain against a window, muted as all things are in those first few bright moments of wakening. Now to totally puncture the mood, that's a short little lyric called Song. The quiet roll of the drum of the washing machine, some residual heat giving from the long radiator against my backside. How a rose opens more and more as it dies, wanting to share one more thing. To think I once volunteered to issue all this music. The washing machine roars through the thick walls as the first day of winter poses like a dusty photograph you blew on. The motes lift off, smile-inducing. I persist, regardless, against all advice. And the last poem I'll read, it's a bit kooky. It's from the perspective of a failed, but bear with me. I wrote this poem a couple of years ago, actually, and it's set in Chríslach, which is would have historically been a place of great potato harvest back in the day. And the damage of the fungus, I can't believe I'm saying this, sounds so Irish, but the damage of the potato famine was it actually totally ruined the nutrient quality of the soil, so it had to be repaired over years and years. So I thought this was interesting, and this poem is a field who witnesses two young men having a dalliance together on that field. Late blight. The field had spent years drinking rain and pills, received infusions, dialysis, pesticide repair. Now, Chríslach breathes again. Its scarred mouth opens, sleep furry. The field is threaded through for the new harvest, overwintered. The lambs, heartily woolen, bounce over orange soil to find a newer water, frost hardy. Some are quick-footed, some come back later. Others love this image, their children alive, young ones loving cappuccinos. The field understood, knew they had to flock elsewhere, busy restitching its root intestine networks. Years later, the field mid-rosary was appeared to, two boys in soil-brown dungarees, one leading the other by the hand, not disturbing the braided potato ridges. They skirt the edges and disappear into the thin wood. Fuck my mouth, hears the field, and in response, hopes they stay. It has pierced its ears with helberine and blue-eyed grass. The boys come out eventually from the trees, holding cans like prayer beads. Come back home, says the field. Some beer is spilled generously for the field. I'm awake, the field says, reeling. Thanks for listening.
Thanks, Micheál. Our third reader is Toby Buckley. Toby is an archivist and writer from Donegal, currently based in Belfast. He completed his MA in creative writing at the Seamus Heaney Centre as the first recipient of the Ruth West Poetry Award Scholarship. His work has appeared in numerous literary publications, including Poetry Ireland Review, The Stinging Fly, Channel Magazine, and the Dura Press anthology Empty House 2021. His debut pamphlet, Milk Snake, was published in July 2022. It explores queerness, displacement, and trauma through clear-voiced, deceptively gentle poems about fishermen, maggots, and bees. Thank you.
Hello. Thank you very much for coming. It's a rare treat to get to be on stage with so many attractive people. This poem is called Men Gathering Honey, and it's about a cave painting. The men are naked from the neck down, protected in no way from bee stings, grass cuts, or rope burns. They straddle a rudimentary ladder of esparto grass, which is plentiful in this region, and reach for a hole in the rock face. Archaeologists think the sack of honey they carry is made from some sort of skin. Around the men on the rock, gigantic bees tumble out, all heads and bellies and wings. They are worried for their queen. The men are worried for their honey, lower it gingerly down their ladder for magic, religion, alcohol, or just something sweeter than flesh to eat. We don't know exactly when men began to eat and drink bees' honey, but it was more than 10,000 years ago, and long before farmers were invented. It's really exciting to be at a queer poetry event, but I always feel like my poems are not very good at being queer poems. It's just, they're just about cool things that I like, but maybe that's queer culture. Let's go for that. This one's called Shaping Stuff, and it's sort of about sausages. It's also the source of the title for my pamphlet, Milk Snake. Shaping Stuff. The first thing I learned at university was that boiled sausages are almost healthy, an alternative to their fried selves. They taste similar, but now their skins slick off, sad and prophylactic. I would like to see what forces could do the same weird thing to me, make me guiltless and lean, and let me shed my skin. If I picked a shape, I think I'd like to be a snake, a milk snake, or really any form of lovable snake. I'd leave ghosts of myself everywhere. I'd leave them like you leave footprints. My last poem is called Pickling. For some reason, I'm always nervous about reading this one. And the reason is that it originally included the word buttocks. And I took it out, but just knowing that it was originally in there makes me blush. It's just, they must not know that I have a bottom. But now you all know my deep secret. Pickling. My head underwater in the bath sounds the same as it does in every house I've lived in, like heartbeats, muffled voices, machines whirring far away. In here, I must try hard not to think about body parts jarred in formaldehyde, but bends in the water make my vessel look corpse-ish, bloated and wrong. I am almost as hollow as a water wing, because when I breathe in, my body floats up to the surface, but my base stays on the bottom like a set of eggs. It's a welcome sign that the sulfurous gases haven't filled me, that I'm not yet rotten. Thank you.
Thanks, Toby. I'm going to introduce our next reader, who's Dawn Watson. Dawn's a writer from Belfast. Her poetry pamphlet, The Stack of Owls Is Getting Higher, was published in 2019 by the Emma Press. Her work has been broadcast on BBC Radio 4 and has appeared in literary journals including Granta, The Manchester Review, The Moth and The Stinging Fly. She was a finalist in the 2020 Michael McLaverty Short Story Awards. She was selected as one of the 2018 Poetry Ireland Introduction Series Poets and won the 2018 Doolin Writers Poetry Award. And her debut collection, We Play Here, is forthcoming with Granta Books in spring 2023.
Thank you. Thank you, Hilary, who has done so much to put together this series of podcasts. Hilary has a very particular skill, which is asking questions in a low-key way that makes you say too much about yourself. So I think I've been quite honest in my podcast, and I'm grateful for that, being afforded that sort of unexpected access to myself. So thank you, Hilary. I'm going to read three poems. The first one I wrote recently for the Transposey Poetry Festival in Brussels. It's very short. It's called Taking the Auspices. The start of things comes so quick. Vandal gulls unwired from the docks. Yark here, over the coal yard. Yark. Unclear why they troop so far inland. Surely not to swoop this steeped lane, this house, its weathered stoop green, fairy lights keening to unfill with rain, trying to tell me it's time, it's time. this second poem I wrote after I crashed for the second time in America recently, and was sort of ticketed by the police. So I've never had an accident in Belfast, but just in America. So this is called Sudden Crash in Hendersonville, North Carolina. Before the storm, you put your phone on the lawn to take a picture of us doing handstands. The cabin's triangle glass yawns yellow. You snap mostly grass in the photograph, which implies more life than can be captured by looking. Red ants paused, mute, katydids, cicadas stumped and halted. A blue wall of plump rain vaults over the ridge, past the spot we saw a ticked mama deer kneel and nudge her baby back to life. Lightning keels the air above the busy street. Over the tall dog tethered to a truck bed, yo-yoing at the stoplights and green lights, or the big hen house with a hand-drawn Led Zepp tailplate barreling home. You grin with something like the force of geckos and duck as the 18-wheeler cuts the lights outside Hot Dog World. Its patrons eat footlongs under white llama wool comforters and watch a rucked gas tank sail high over soot pink magnolias, trailing the sort of fire that makes us feel wanted, even loved. final poem is really quite random. It's just one of my favorite TV shows from the 90s, Most Haunted Live. Just as a bit of background, Derek Acora was one of the spirit mediums, and he was sort of exposed as being a fake, but he always said that he had this spirit guide called Sam. So this is really a poem about Sam. this is Most Haunted Live. In the afternoons, I wonder about Sam, the spirit guide of the late Derek Acora, the medium from Most Haunted on TV. The day his ventriloquizing stopped must have been a hard one. Very hard for a ghost of Sam's obvious articulacy and vast social network of poltergeists. Who will speak for Sam now at Halloween when Yvette Fielding lands in with Carl to a York Manor lit up blue and green? One thing I know, and I don't know much, is most of what they say about us isn't true. What's that, Sam? Who will speak for you in the dry ice, in the seance, when the jib crane picks up movement in the lobby? Some replacement happy medium reveals betrayal happened here, near the chintz, beneath the teardrop twistle chandelier. The mounted thermal image cam reveals a cold spot in the corner by the tall boy, about the size of you, Sam. Or smaller. Thanks very much.
Our final reader is Paul Maddern, who was born in Bermuda to Irish and Cornish parents and has lived in Northern Ireland since 2000. He has a PhD from the Seamus Heaney Centre and has taught creative writing there and at the University of Leeds. He has four publications with Templar Poetry: Kelpdings, The Beachcomber's Report, Pilgrimage and The Tipping Line. His poem, If Assay, is on the Northern Irish GCSE syllabus. He's the recipient of two Bermuda Government Literary Awards and several Arts Council of Northern Ireland Awards, including funds from the 2021 Individual Emergency Resilience Programme, which supported work on the anthology Queering the Green, post-2000 queer Irish poetry, of which he is editor. He owns and operates the River Mill Writers Retreat in County Down, Northern Ireland. Thanks, Paul.
Good evening, and thank you, Hilary. I'm just echoing the thanks of everyone here for the project that you've undertaken, and it's terrific. So thank you very much, and to your team as well. I'm going to read two poems. They're longish, I suppose, but not unbearably, I hope. The first is called Of the Vein, and it was written, there was a conference here years ago for Louis MacNeice's centenary, and there was really no mention of Auden, who was, I just found that very strange. So this started out as a tribute to him, but has mutated into something a little bit different, perhaps. Of the Vein. There, beyond the green check lawn, the group who keep to shade and doff their boaters to the beauties, but fix an eye or eight on passers-by to warn them of a boundary. Says John to James, dates, figs, and plums, old chum, look you there on deserts spread on a picnic blanket. Here one adds, as one must, some rolling thunder. James to John, I hear, when it rains, Japanese ladies invert their parasols to catch chrysanthemums. One elder wanders off, as eventually one must. From underneath a willow tree, he leads his boy to bed and to obituaries. Matt to Tom, when bird watching, I use opera glasses to spy the best throated, don't you know? And so the code continues. Here two dashes, there a dot, passed down the generations, or in lapel carnations, pinned by practiced hands. Matt to James to John to Tom, perhaps in Greek with masks. Four marble peacocks move and shape their own mythologies. Here one adds, as one must, some desperate laughter. Tom to John to Matt to James, perhaps en masse they gesture. Let's raise a finger to detractors. Now, there beyond the green check lawn, only parts survive. There, there now. A high brow, an elegant calf, a digit raised, displayed like this. And here, I gesture. Or, as if there'd been a choice, a neck set at an angle ripe for striking, muscles flexed by an adoring sculptor, veins plumped and fit for bursting, green, reclaimed. I say, I inherit the vein glorious. And then a poem. I lived in San Francisco for a while, on and off, illegally. And I worked at a place called the Patio Cafe, which, if you knew the Castro in those days, it doesn't exist any longer, but it was one of the sort of gay Mecca points on that street. And this is called Queer Lit. In 85, I worked for Wolfgang, the Patio Cafe's head honcho, who died when his convertible nosedived near Sausalito. The beautiful boy beside him, Chris, made it out alive. The boy, Carl, was famous for the snake he wore as a boa and his alarming contact lenses, checkerboards, and tiger stripes. Carlo? I know he mixed a great margarita, and one day he vanished. And Stephen died, hooked on speed supplied by his lover, our manager, elegant Stephen, who launched himself off a balcony to simply end a disagreement. And Michael died. Another from the patio stable, a passive muscle man who paid for the heydays of sex in the alleyways and beer gardens of Folsom Street clubs. And Tim, a waiter who would become a lawyer, who laughed with me and was tender with me, I learned from Facebook, died from AIDS complications. Many I met at the Midnight Sun and the Stud will be dead. Casuals who, after enough to drink and snort, would conduct a brief tour so I wouldn't disturb the house when I left. But I also met you at the Stud, an encounter recalled with particulars exact. Me, perched on the upright barrel to the left of the bar, my hair blonde and long. You, in white jeans, that peach-colored vest scant enough to show off your pecs, black hair gelled and ironed straight up, but it was your skin's sweat and olive gleam that led me to stare. You caught me, came over, spread and planted yourself between my knees. It was aggressive and I enjoyed the surprise. No chat, just nods and a set of car keys. How it developed stays between us. But I'll betray your name, Andreas, hoping someone will know where you are. But if he is dead, don't get in touch. Leave me 30 years ago at a bay window on 18th, watching Andreas ignore the placards and prophets insisting our end is nigh, being absorbed by the rot and luster of a Castro night, and living. Thanks.
Thanks to all of you for those readings. I mean, I think, you know, probably all of you in the room will kind of feel the breadth of voices that we have here and the depth of talent. It's kind of hard to know where to go also from that poem. It's the second time I've heard Paul read it, and it kind of stunned me the first time and has done exactly the same the second time. Kind of very moving piece of work. I think perhaps maybe unusual in if you think about Queering the Green, of which you're editor, a lot of the poems in that are not explicitly about LGBTQ experience, and the one that you've ended on is explicitly. So maybe you just want to talk a bit about how Queering the Green came about, and why you decided that you would have a range of poems from LGBTQ authors.
Well, first of all, I think Manuela Moser and Stephen Connolly are here tonight, the editors of Lifeboat Press, who deserve a round of applause for taking this on. I won't ask you to stand up, it's okay. So yeah, it started with a conversation with Manuela, I believe, at the River Mill. And then Manuela went away and talked to Stephen, and they decided to take it on. I had been sort of touting the idea around a little bit before that, but no one was biting except for the Lifeboat. And then I just started inviting people that I knew, and then a wider invitation, and then a public invitation as well. So we ended up with 31 poets in there. There were 70 submissions. Only one person who didn't want to submit anything at all. And some of the decisions were very difficult. Some were fairly easy, but there were a few that were rough. And you know, on another day, there might be another selection in there. But I'm very happy with people who are in there, and everyone on the stage is in there. But as you I wasn't looking for necessarily for poems about being queer. I just wanted queer writers to send me poems that they liked, really. Some of those are explicitly about queer lifestyle, and there are other poems which Padraig has spoken very eloquently about in terms of the poem itself is queer as opposed to it being about being queer. So I hope there's a range of both of those, you know, throughout the entire anthology. And I just thought it was time to start celebrating, you know, post same-sex marriage down south and up here eventually. Time to start celebrating ourselves with it.
And I think you mentioned when you were reading, Toby, you mentioned that, you know, are your poems queer enough? And then went on to talk a bit further about that. Can you maybe say a bit more about that, what it's like to have that expectation of being a queer poet and then not necessarily read poems that are very explicitly queer?
I think I never really notice that my poems aren't explicitly queer until I'm at an explicitly queer event and realize I have nothing in particular to read. But I think part of the issue is I don't tend to write directly about myself. I have a large amount of hang-ups, and it feels very impolite to put myself in the middle. I'm from a very healthy Presbyterian background, and we have a very healthy relationship with luxury of treating yourself like a human being. So I tend to write about like random things that I happen to like, and I slip myself into them, and sometimes it's a bit gay, because it's like, what if I was a snake? And that could be any sex. Oh. But yeah, I think it's something I need to work on a bit. I don't know. Contact my therapist.
And what about for others of you? How's that been for you as queer writers? And do you kind of claim the word queer along with writer, or do you try and divorce yourself from it?
So I absolutely do, because I think of queerness as, for me, queerness is more like a lens through which I encounter everything, you know. So there's a phrase I keep going back to, which is from a work by Eve Kosofsky Sedgwick, who was one of the kind of forerunners of academic queer theory in the late 80s and early 1990s. And there's a line which I think is from her book Tendencies, where the closest that she will come to defining queer is, keenly it is relational and strange. And I've always loved that quote, and I always loved just that sort of gesture of refusing to define. You know, for me, that is a kind of an inherently queer way of being and making art, to refuse definition, to refuse stability, to just open up for as much indeterminacy as possible. And then I think, how can I do that in the language? How can I embed that into syntax? How can I embed that into poetic form, into grammar? So yes, I do absolutely maintain a sense of myself as a queer poet, but always try to resist queer becoming a noun, you know, allow it to be an adjective, even think of it as an adverb. You know, how can you write queerly?
Were you going to come in on that, Dawn?
No, it absolutely wasn't. I have never described myself as a queer poet or a queer anything. And queer, in fact, wouldn't really ever be a word that I would have used. I think my association with the word queer would be quite a masculine association. I mean, I don't even use the word lesbian, to be honest. I prefer gay woman. But when I think of queer writing, you know, and certainly also to add, I don't really particularly look to be called a queer poet. But I'm happy to talk about being queer. I think it's a retrospective thing with me, with my writing. I mean, when I look at my writing, and I mean, for example, We Play Here, the book that's coming out next year, I wrote that as part of my PhD. And as part of that, I had to write a very self-reflective 10,000 word sort of critical essay that sort of examined what I was doing in it, which was hard because I don't know what I was doing in it. And but when I look at these four children that I wrote about, it's all four speakers and they're all 12 years old, I realized that I actually had pictured them all as being queer. And it's not obvious that that's the case. I think it's mentioned maybe once, where the dad sort of says, you know, about, you know, your future girl. And but other than that, it's more to do with their appearance. This sort of, they're on the cusp of their teenage years. They're sort of strangely ungendered in a way, sort of untouched by that kind of the trappings of gender. And it comes just before that. But there are times throughout, on reflection, that I can see where I have written an otherness, and I have written these children are living in abject spaces. And even times when they have actively tried to assert their queerness, like there's one scene where a kid goes into a shop and buys some fish fingers and some penguins, and goes up to the counter, and the shopkeeper says, "You from here?" And the kid's like, "No, I'm from America." And the shopkeeper says, "Right, you are 10:20. And there's just this feeling of just, in whatever way possible, just sort of getting it out there that you feel different and you're aware of that. And just the last thing I'm going to say about it, I mean, Kieran Carson was very influential in the book. And I think of how he spoke of those, of the city as having these microscopic bits that in some ways change depending on how you look at them. And I do think it's inevitable whenever I write about a pan loaf bag tied to a railing. You know, these are the things that I notice. And as a queer person, I'm inevitably going to be queering Belfast when I write it. And I'm conscious of that, but not at the time, I guess, I'm writing it, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, I think that does make sense. I don't know if any, tell me more. Other poets, did that make sense to you? How does that resonate with your own experience of writing?
I love that particularly, because it's not, you know, determined in advance of the writing. I think you're like just procedurally working through whatever it is you want to write. I think that's really overdetermined, the idea that now to write a queer Sestina, you know, it's not quite like that. I mean, I don't really know how to follow that, though, to be honest. Thanks. I hesitate sometimes the writing of queer content because it's very, like, if you look at, like, the publishing world now, you know, like, there's queer anthologies everywhere and there's subsequently queer pain everywhere. And sometimes I worry about, I think, about privacy in poems as well, like, what you disclose, what you don't, and things like this. So it's not as easy as we've succeeded civil rights now, and that's grand. Mm-hmm. Also, I think it's like it's important to think critically about what you can and can't disclose, because if that makes a certain way to write a poem, like to be queer is you have to talk about what's difficult or what's going on, then if you don't want to do that, you're not queer. And I think that's really dangerous, and that's, I think, the real accomplishment of Queer in the Green is that Paul included all these approaches to writing queerly, and I think that's the thrill, that like we're all just doing wildly different things. Like, you know, I guess for me, like, I'm irreconcilably Catholic, for example. You know, but like, and I'm not trying to queer the Catholic Church or faith or anything like that, but yeah. Well, stay tuned. No, just kidding. But yeah, I think it's just a question of approach, and I think once you become dogmatic, you may as well be heterosexual or whatever. I don't know.
Yeah, see, that's...
Don't go that far.
Like, that's a perspective that I find myself really agreeing with. And like, something that I'm very kind of concerned about at the minute is, you know, what is the ultimate efficacy and indeed ethics of a poetics based upon the disclosure of an identity? You know, what does that do in a moment of surveillance capitalism, okay? What does that do when our identities are, you know, just being fed back into sort of neoliberal and capitalist structures in order to sell us more products? Is it perhaps not a more radical act now to try to dissociate ourselves from any identity categories or to try to destroy them from within?
Say more. Or how would we go about... So, I mean, I guess for me, so I'm older than most of you. And so when I was coming out, it was into really quite a hostile atmosphere. It's part of why I left this place. I left here in 1984 and had no plan to come back. And visibility was a big issue, that, you know, everything was so hidden. And that kind of sense that we hardly existed. And so it was okay to kind of persecute LGBT people because there weren't hardly, in fact, there wasn't even B&T. It was really just LG was mentioned. It was okay to persecute them because they were hardly any of them existed, and they were all nasty and horrible and deserved it. You know, and so kind of visibility and owning the voice was, I think, really quite an important thing to do. But it feels like maybe there's a sense that we don't need to do that anymore. Is that...
Well, I think perhaps these things have always been going back and forth. And of course, like, particular identity categories or identity positions can do a lot of very good work in terms of, you know, defining a space from which to make political or artistic action. It's just a question of, you know, we have to be able, or we have to be willing to move beyond them as and when it seems like a more useful political strategy, I think. Mm.
It's a funny one as well when you go back into history. Like, for example, Auden's, I think, first book, or perhaps his second collection of poems, was called Look, Stranger, 1936. And the you in all those poems is to a man. So I think it's all about... there's a very strange thing now that have going on where people are, like, anthologizing queer literature and they're going back to Elizabeth Bishop and say, you know, this incredibly coded, really complicated poetry. And it's a funny editorial decision in it to, like, retrospectively say, oh, well, this is queer, when it was so inappropriate to say such a thing at the time. It's almost like a code switch, I think. And I wonder what you all think about that, but it just interests me, you know, like a kind of like a historical unveiling. But like Adrienne Rich, who was a lesbian woman, reportedly on a road trip across America with Elizabeth Bishop, got, like, you know, like side to side of America, and was like, I had no idea she was a lesbian until someone told her, like, 3 weeks after. So if if that was someone's personal decision with another queer person, I don't know, it's interesting, you know.
Yeah, and I think they were at the same university for a time. you might know, I think Dawn's more of an Elizabeth Bishop kind of expert, but I'm pretty sure that at least for some of the time, Adrian Rich was in the same university as Elizabeth Bishop.
Vassar, I think so. No, I agree. With what Micheál was saying there about Elizabeth Bishop, you know, she's an American poet. She's known for her poetry, but she's also known for being very, very hesitant to talk about her personal life and her personal issues. So she was also an alcoholic, but she was queer. You know, her mom was taken to an insane asylum, as it was termed, when she was 5 years old, and she never saw her again. And so there was a lot of things that really set Elizabeth Bishop apart and othered her, other than just her gender, her sort of sexual identity. But she, in her prose writing, for some reason, she let herself off the leash, and she would write a lot in an autobiographical way about being, she wouldn't have called herself a queer child, but she would have talked about how dresses were an absolute horror. She had to wear them. She had to play with a doll. Oh my God, you know, just the sort of dread of that. And it's something I identified with a lot. I mean, I remember, you know, when you went to see Santa and you had to pick your present out of the pink bin, and it was like a plastic mirror and a comb, and it was horrendous. And so to sort of read these stories and see her write about this a very recognizable to me queer experience, it's so astonishing, because she's really not known as a queer poet, and that she's not really talked about in those terms. But again, it's someone writing their lived experience and writing their sort of how they're at odds and sort of feeling incongruous with the world around them. And you know, I have a lot of time with that, and I don't think that's necessarily a queer thing, but it absolutely is a queer thing at the same time.
Yeah, I think there's always been a sort of that two-pronged approach. I mean, if you think of someone like James Merrill, the American poet, very explicitly writing about being queer, maybe not about having anal sex with his boyfriend or something, but you know, he's talking about being queer. Ashbery and of course others, you know. So it's not as if all of a sudden people are suddenly writing about being queer. I mean, that has been going on for a considerable amount of time now. And I'm not sure, you know, with the world as it is at the moment, if moving away from identity poetry is necessarily the way forward. I don't know, but I think there is certainly something in what Padraic says about, you know, about these boundaries and these terms and these names and their usefulness. In the rarefied world of poetry and art, perhaps those discussions are not relating directly to people's lives lived on the ground. But there is that room, I think, for us to be talking in those terms as well, definitely. But this is a conversation that's been going on for generations.
I wondered if anybody else found the same thing. I find when I just listened to Paul, what you're saying there about writing queer, when I sit down to write a poem, and I rarely do it, but I did write a poem about the time I was Pride Princess in 2002, and I got barred from the Kremlin. And I find that when I write about things that are queer, I tend to be more like straight with it, you know, or like more straightforward and as clear as I can be. But I feel when I'm writing more generally that maybe I'm searching more for that surprising language and that kind of a feeling that's maybe more of a sense of how I experience the world, you know. So I wondered if anybody else finds that.
Now that you mention it, yes. And it's just occurred to me that it's when I do want to write explicitly about queer politics or about queer issues or about queer narratives, I tend to do that in prose, you know, whereas with the poetry, I'm much more interested in allowing the queerness to bend the language into all these weird shapes. But when I want to actually write about something, when I actually have something to say, I need the space that the prose sentence and the paragraph and the essay can afford me.
I'm glad somebody's mentioning the prose word. So I write prose. I don't write poetry. I can't write poetry. Well, probably I could write poetry, but it would be, you know, of the kind of maybe a 7-year-old child variety. And yet I've got these 5 poets with me. Actually, to be fair, you also do... I think probably all of you do write prose in other forms. Well, Don's written short stories, and Paul, you've got the kind of introduction to Queer in the Green, obviously, is a prose, and you've got read your essay around Belfast, and you've done work for Radio 4. I'm not sure about you, Toby, on the prose side.
I mean, I used to write, like, listicles. So that's it.
But nevertheless, most of you are primarily known as poets. And why do you think more poets are coming through? So you all did your master's in poetry at the Seamus Heaney Centre, and several of you have now also got PhDs from the Heaney Centre. Why do you think more queer poets have come through the Heaney Centre than prose writers? Because I feel I'm a bit Billy No Mates over here.
I have no idea. when I was doing my MA in, 2004 and 5, there was myself and Gail McConnell. No, she wasn't doing her master's in poetry. She was doing a English degree master's. But she was part of the writers group that Sinead Morrissey was in charge of it in those days. And I think it was just us two at the time. So I guess, you know, we just inspired everyone to go there and be gay. I don't know.
I mean, well, you're saying that as a joke, but there may be some truth to it.
No.
Like, I know you were the first person who taught me creative writing when I was a second year undergraduate at Queen's. And I don't know if I would have gone on to do masters and stuff were it not for your classes.
Oh, that's very sweet. Thank you. Thank you. God. I think there is an element to the fact that, you know, the fact that there have been quite a few in recent years, there have been quite a few queer people there doing something. I think it probably does attract other queer people to come there. Just to be around that atmosphere, I think, really, and have those conversations and talk about their poetry in those terms. Yeah. But also, I mean, it's also the quality of generally the quality that's produced by the Seamus Heaney Centre is very high, you know, so I think that's probably the main reason most people come there. Yeah.
I guess it sounds from what you're saying that you've all found it an accepting place to explore whatever it is you wanted to write about.
I mean, I wouldn't say it's perfect, but yes, it's definitely been a place that I've found, definitely it's been a very useful place for me to be.
It's a place that prizes really good writing and wants to make really good writers. I've never really felt like the content of what I was writing was ever, not, I don't mean of interest, but it was like, is this poem good? Leontia Flynn said to me once that what makes a poem interesting is not what it's about, but how it goes about being what it's about. And I think that's a pretty integral philosophy to any good place of writing. And that's how I've always felt about it. In response to your earlier question as well, perhaps it's a very simple logistical answer in that poems don't take as long to write than queer novels, maybe. Anyway, sorry, just spitballing. But,
yeah, but that still doesn't really explain why there aren't more, amongst the prose writers, why there aren't more queer writers. I might go off and ponder that. Maybe I need to be doing more to recruit. You know, there was that old thing, you know, we recruit.
Yeah, I mean, I think Stephen Sexton, who's also a poet and teaches at the Heaney Centre, I know he would have spoken about poetry as a form that lives in the air. And when I think about queerness and gayness and all of that, it does feel like something very amorphous, and it feels like something that goes hand in hand instinctively with poetry. And if I were to write a novel, you know, about being queer, I've just done this PhD where I've looked at the difference between poetry and prose in a sense and what this kind of benefits are of almost writing in each form, and there is something I think in writing in prose that lends itself to a sort of a linear narrative, you know, the way that things just kind of come out of you in terms of timeline and order, whereas sitting down to write a poem in this kind of lineated way really to me was something that I had to learn how to sort of create a narrative in that kind of staccato way that a poem always struck me as being. And yet once I kind of aligned myself with that, I felt it kind of more accurately in some way represented how I kind of, interact with the world in terms of brevity and moments and synapses and, you know, tiny instances and details and sort of at that cellular level. So I don't think that answers your question at all, but... Yeah, on reflection. But
Well, I've just thought about, what's the line that you wrote in the introduction to Queering the Green Poll, where you talk about, like, every poem is a queering of language. You know, if we think of queering as a kind of making strange or of a sort of slanted or oblique approach to something, which is what the etymology of queer ultimately is. The word queer comes from the German quer, which means slantwise or oblique or at a strange angle to something else. And that is the relationship that a good poem must have to language.
No, I mean, I absolutely stand by that. I mean, I think, like you, I think the... It's not really what the poem's about necessarily that interests me at all. It's how the poem was made. And if those two things marry up, you know, if the content and the form, this is an old, you know, trope, if the content and the form marry up, then I think it becomes a good, interesting poem. But I'm actually more concerned about how the poem is made. The integrity, if you like, of the poem, as a piece of art. You know, and I think we should all be striving to, you know, produce something that we can stand over. You know, we consistently fail at doing that, but I think we should be striving to produce something that is of artistic merit. You know.
So just on that is then, so how do you as writers, how do you approach your writing, and how do you approach trying to get down on the page whatever it is you want to work out, and then making it as good as you possibly can? Anybody kind of want to offer anything about what their process is for how they write?
Well, my process is not having a process. I mean, I just, I am absolutely pathetic at having some sort of daily routine when it comes to writing. I'm too busy with the River Mill, really, to have much time to write. So I think I've maybe like a third of a collection ready since 2018 when the last one came out. So it's not exactly an amazing rate of production. But I'm also not concerned with that really either. I just think it comes when it comes. It's not like I have any obligations to produce the number of goods that academic people need to do within their ref return period. I don't have any of that. I don't have a publisher who's breathing down my neck, or an agent saying, where's the next book? So I just take my time, really. And I've learned over the years not to put any pressure on myself. It comes when it comes.
Yeah, I'm very much the same way. Like, I mean, I'm just completely incompetent at, managing life. So I have no routine when it comes to writing. Well, I used to write a lot, between like sort of 1 and 5 in the morning, because I was also nocturnal for a long time. But for me, it's always like I need to, like, the poem comes when I feel like I should be doing something else. I feel like I need to steal time in order to write the poem. And I guess perhaps some of it is like a real fear that it would ever become rote to me, the point at which I feel like I've got particularly comfortable in a form or in a particular sort of approach to the language, well, then it's going to start to become very boring. I like the idea that I would aspire to be able to, completely remake my processes in response to whatever was the impetus for the poem. There's a writer called Anthony Cappaldeo, who I think is magnificent at this. There is no Anthony Cappaldeo style of a poem. They will completely reinvent who they are as a poet for every text. And I think that that's just a really admirable way of going about it.
Can I just jump in there and say, I think Kieran Carson also is a great example of that, how he reinvented himself consistently across his entire writing career, and was just a shining example of exactly that kind of thing. And that's the idea of integrity, and always striving to do something that is of interest in a dynamic and changing.
I remember when I interviewed Toby, one of the most alarming things that you said to me was that you have the draft and then you just type over it and you don't save it. You don't save the original, you just type over it. And that scared me more than I can tell you. So yeah, maybe just tell us a bit about your process.
It's true, I'm a horrible little writing gremlin. I think my process changes like constantly, because I think I'm the only person on stage who has not attempted like poetry academia. I just have like a 9-to-5 job, so it's exceedingly difficult to trick my brain into going from like an Excel spreadsheet to le poetry. So yeah, right now I just scribble out all my thoughts into like a little one of those Aisling copybooks that you had in primary school, and then hit my laptop, which doesn't have a one key or an A key, and try and massage it into a poem. And then I just close my eyes and send it off somewhere. And if it is accepted, then yes, it was a poem. And if it is rejected, then I guess it wasn't a poem. And not worthy of keeping and full of shame, so delete. That's it. That's my process. Once again, please refer to my therapist.
Oh, yeah, I don't know. I think probably most of the prose writers I know do keep drafts, previous drafts, and the idea of kind of losing something would haunt me. I couldn't
burn
do
the
that.
Evidence.
Just do you keep drafts, Padraig? And I know
I never like. I never want to like, you know, be reminded of a past version of myself. That's terrifying. They were all awful.
I think I'm going to have to lie down in the room and have a drink later.
I don't know why we would. I mean, who's going to want to see them? I mean, they're just terrible. The earlier drafts of the poems.
Well, I was talking to Dawn about this on another occasion, and I think if you look at Elizabeth Bishop's One Art, the poem One Art, seeing the early version and then seeing the final version, I found so interesting.
No, okay, yeah, okay. But she never wanted people to see those. You know, there was a huge controversy around that book that came out, you know, when it came out, about all the early drafts being published. I just don't think she... Dawn could speak to that much more than I can. But
no.
It's great for students.
I don't think she would have probably liked it either, but, you know, she also was drunk a lot of the time and left a lot of things lying around. And, I mean, yeah, I don't keep drafts either, to be honest. I have now made a note in my phone as a result of talking to you to think about that more, but drafts are just, no. I can see it with prose. I mean, I can see it with prose, but with poetry, no. You just try to improve it. And I don't know if it's from my own background. I worked as a journalist, as a sub-editor specifically for like 20 years. And so I'm used to working with words and reducing them into the utmost compression and putting them into little columns. And I think that does actually kind of come out in how I approach. From the off, I tend to write in a very compressed way and I need to expand it. So it's kind of the reverse draft.
But it is a useful teaching tool, you know, I have to say. I mean, there's an awful version of Lake Alav in Ishri, which is really useful to, you know, compare the two, what he started off with and what he ended up with. So in that regard, you know, that occasionally, yes, an early draft is a useful thing.
Well, can I ask, how much do you guys draft? Because I don't do a huge amount of drafting. Like, I think I remember you teaching us a class about drafting and I didn't listen. Because I like, for me, it's like I won't move on to the next stanza of a poem until I know that the previous stanza is pretty much in the shape that it's going to be. You know, I think perhaps because the sort of logical and rhetorical structure of the poem is the guiding principle for me, I need to have that in place before. Like, if I've reached the last line of a poem, it's pretty much going to stay in that shape. It may change a word or two. So how much, like, do you radically change poems between drafts?
Oh, quite a bit. Yeah. Well, I would write a poem perhaps and then put it away for a long time and then come back to it. And the poem that I thought was going to change the world, I realize is just absolute rubbish. And I might save a line or two from it and then start again. So there have been poems where I have, like yourself, I've gone from the beginning to the end. And then I thought, well, okay, this is good. And I need to change this X, Y, and Z. But overall, it's fine.
Yeah, you probably, I mean, draft a lot, but I just don't keep them. You know, I sort of just go over it and over it in this palimpsestic way until it's totally ready. I don't have like final doc X, doc two, doc final or anything, you know, of a poem. It's just, it's gone. It's just the one.
Yeah, maybe one. It's just me that's neurotic. I'm kind of always kind of worried, oh, maybe that was much better but earlier. And I'm always frightened that I'm going to lose it. So maybe I need to learn to be more like poets. and less like an anxious prose writer. You're also freewheeling with your let's just write over it and not worry.
I think I fall down more on Padraig's side of things. I usually sit and think about it for like 6 months before I put pen to paper. And then if it's still in my mind and feels good, it usually comes out quickly and in the shape of, because I've been kind of like patting it, massaging it into shape for so long. But yeah, I don't know if I would have many. Yeah, I think I'm so neurotic that I'm like, I can't finish this now. So I usually put it away and then 2 weeks later, I'm like, oh, okay. I think what's clear is we're all just really lazy. But I think poetry is one of those few fields where you can kind of get away with that. Well, not at least laziness is extreme, but concentrated thought for a long period of time, sitting down, you know.
There's something just about, for me, just writing moments and sort of incongruities and things that just, little tiny moments. Like I was in a queue one day in the shop and I realized I was like pressing my thumb and my finger together and I'd made a little blood blister and something about that. You know, I just had to write that down, or I'd be on a run and I realize I'm, you know, licking my lips in a particular way and it reminds me of something or someone you know, you stop and you write that down and those notes can just stay there for a long time, you know, until suddenly maybe they make sense and you put the poem down. Or
I think perhaps some of it for me is that, like, because I can't just write a poem out of an idea, I often kind of need two ideas, which I will have some sort of intuitive sense that these two things are connected. And then the process of writing the poem will be working out how they might connect to each other. And so kind of once that process is more or less complete, or once I think I've worked out a logic there, then I feel kind of comfortable to just stop writing the poem.
Well, I think that might be this place we're going to stop recording this podcast, because I think we could probably spend another, well, ages talking about process. And it feels like, yeah, maybe we've all got our own processes. But I don't kind of want to quite finish here, because I feel I haven't quite captured just how much joy I have got from interviewing all of you and how much joy I got from reading all of your work. So one of the great things about doing the fellowship was I actually had time to read all of the work of these fantastic writers. And I really would urge people not just to buy Queering the Green, but also to buy other work of all of these poets, because there is so much in it and so much that you will get from it. So I think we're going to finish now just with a round of applause for our poets. And also just a final thanks again to all the Seamus Heaney Centre staff and to everybody who's helped contribute to the podcast. And also thanks very much to all of you for coming tonight, and to Outburst for partnering. And don't forget to fill in your evaluation forms. And if you want to buy books, I'm sure that our fabulous writers will be available if anybody wants to have any of their work signed. So thanks again for coming.
Thank you for listening to the Queer at Queen's podcast with Hilary McCollum and all of our previous poets in a live recording at Crescent Arts Centre.